Good evening. I'd like to welcome you all to the November 15th, 2018 regular meeting of the City Planning Commission. And we have a roll call, please.
Chair Stan Iser. Here. Vice Chair Matthew Nolan. Here. Commissioner Stephen Maloney.
Here.
Commissioner Brian Hyatt. Commissioner Daniel Mills.
Here.
Commissioner Jennifer Parker. And Commissioner Dennis Teschlag. Good evening. We're back again. We talked about this last month, the proposed code amendments in there regarding code enforcement. And tonight we're back for the official public hearing. Not a lot of public interest. We don't have anybody in the audience, but I would like to officially enter into the record Planning Commission Resolution 2018-165, along with the attached staff report. The PowerPoint presentation, and should we have any public testimony, that will go in the record as well. Starting with a little bit of background, the responsibility for code enforcement recently transitioned to development services, and we found that the code can be difficult to enforce, so we did a review and proposed some amendments to make it easier. And at this point, I'd just like to clarify that the city attorney has reviewed the amendments, and the suggestions that were made last week were incorporated. So at this point, I'm going to give you guys the option. You all heard the presentation. You all saw it in the staff report. Do you want to hear it again? You have a choice. You don't have to sit through it all again if you don't want to.
I'd say let's pass on it. We've all heard it.
Yep.
And I would.
Okay. So we could move on to discussion.
Open the public hearing.
There's nobody signed up on the sheet.
No, they have not.
Close the public hearing and ask for a motion to adopt the resolution, the draft of which is in the packet.
I move to adopt the resolution. Aye.
That was a record. The best public hearing ever. Yeah, awesome. Now we get to have the movie without the popcorn.
Get that set up. Can I just
next item?
Oh, yeah. I'll let Tom go, and then we'll watch the movie.
Okay, so the next item, I had mentioned that the last month that the small cell, the 5G wireless facilities was going to be on our work program, be a focus of the next few months, and that is still true. These new rules that the FCC adopted go into effect on January the 14th. Given how often the Planning Commission meets and some of the work that needs to be done, it's not likely that we will have everything through the Council and adopted by that date, but we're going to be working towards that. There may be something, an interim regulation come through that's sort of a very little bit of a rougher version that we'll probably have something in place, so that'll probably come in the next meeting. But what I'd like to do tonight is the attorney that we work with, Ogden Murphy Wallace, her name is Alana Zana, and we were invited to watch a webinar. And so our own attorney that's working with our city presented a webinar, and she's actually an expert known statewide She's worked with a lot of jurisdictions on wireless communication facility issues. And so about the first two-thirds of this webinar deals with the things that we're going to be talking about in the next month or two as we go through through the process of coming up with regulations dealing with the 5G, the small cells. So I'd like to play that for you. After we're done, we can talk about it a little bit, but staff is not prepared to really – what we know is what you're going to see. We do have – Sherry's done some research, but we're really not prepared to go into the depth of the details yet. We're still going to be working with our consultant, Alana. So with that, if you have any questions before we get it started, I'll fire it up. You want to, you're closer.
Yeah. Oh, you want me to do it?
It'll probably be a new chapter. Right now, we have wireless communication facilities in our conditional use permit chapter, and the recommendations we're getting from our legal counsel is that it's best to have it more of a ministerial, to have really good, strong standards in your regulations, but have it be more like a building permit, to where you don't have to go through a public hearing and appeal process, just because it's a much more efficient way to do it, and a lot of the issues that people bring up at public hearings, we're not allowed to listen to anyways as far as the strength of the signals. The federal laws preempt local jurisdictions from even considering those things, and so it creates false expectations to have people think they can bring in stuff off the Internet and enter it as evidence, but the city's position really is that, you know, that as long as it meets what the FCC is, says what the rules are, and that's what they are. So. So the answer to your question directly is we'll probably have a new section called wireless, but I'm not positive. But that's probably, it's likely to do that, but we're going to have to amend some of the existing rules as well. So we'll probably have to reformat our existing conditional use permit section to take some of that stuff out, and they'll probably have a separate section called wireless communication facilities. But that's just what I'm guessing right now. Okay. Oh, and when it starts going into some other stuff about cable TV franchise and stuff, I'm just going to get up and turn it off because it does go a little off track at the end.
Today's topic will cover the FCC new small cell order and what it means to our cities in Washington. My name is Liliana Dickinson. I am the marketing specialist here at Ogden Murphy Wallace. And joining me here today are four of our telecommunications attorneys, Alana Zana, Emily Miner, Scott Snyder, and Daniel Kenny. Just a few quick notes. In your sidebar, you'll notice that there's a place to ask questions. We will have time at the end of the presentation for Q&A. So as we work through the presentation, make sure to type in your questions, and we will answer as many as we can at the end. We are also recording this presentation, and we will share it with you in the next few days along with the PowerPoint. Now kicking off to the presentation is Alana Zana. Alana is the chair of our telecommunications group. She counsels municipalities on a broad range of telecommunications-related matters. Hello, Alana.
Thank you so much, Lily, and welcome, everybody. It's great to see such a good crowd on our webinar today. We have, as Lily mentioned, a wonderful group of attorneys that are focusing on the new rules and helping you prepare your code and franchises for compliance with the FCC order. So we have a lot to cover today, and I really want to start by appreciating the help of AWC, WETOA, and MRSC for spreading the word about this webinar. We know that this is a hot topic in many of your cities, and we hope that this overview provides enough information to get your process jump-started or modified to comply with the rule. So how did we get here, and what happened? So first and foremost, I want to talk about the agenda today. We're doing a overview of the FCC small cell order, which I'll be speaking with, and then we're going to talk further about the permitting shot clocks, because that is a very specific part of the FCC rule that will affect the public works and development services departments and will really help you manage how what happens when you get applications in. We'll then move to the practical implications of the FCC small cell rule here in Washington State. And we'll touch for a few minutes on the FCC NPRM on cable franchise fees. Lastly, we will end with question and answers. And as Lily mentioned before, please send in your questions during this presentation. We'll be recording them. And at the end, we will review them and discuss out loud. Just as a quick note, we want to make it very clear that this presentation is for educational purposes only. It's not designed to provide legal advice. And if you have specific questions, please contact your city attorney for an interpretation of these legal matters. So the FCC rule was issued in late September, and it became published in the Federal Register a couple weeks ago, which gives it an effective date of January 14th, 2018, which means everything we're going to cover today, save one issue that we'll talk about, will have to be implemented by that date in order to be best prepared for the pending applications that are coming. Now, that being said, there is pending appeals. One of them will be likely in the Ninth Circuit. And if you have questions regarding any litigation, please contact any one of us after this webinar, and we can give you information about law firms that are pursuing litigation. One other piece to note is there's no automatic stay with this FCC order. So it will become effective January 14th unless a stay is granted by the Ninth Circuit, another court of appeals, or the FCC itself. As I mentioned before, we're also going to talk about the notice of proposed rulemaking, and I just put up on this slide for your reference the dates that the comments are due, as well as any reply comments. And I apologize, there is a typo on this slide. We put January 14th, 2018, but actually the effective date is January 14th, 2019. So let's talk about one of the major issues that happened in the FCC order, and that was a change in the definition or the interpretation of effective prohibition as it relates to the statutory structure of 332 and 253. So unlike the 10 years of Ninth Circuit jurisprudence that we've been familiar with, they basically took the significant gap in coverage and least intrusive means tests and threw it in the garbage. And now instead what we have is the FCC materially inhibits standard. This standard is based off of an old 1997 FCC case involving physical payphones. So we're now back to the dark ages, even though we're dealing with new technology that we've yet to see. So the materially inhibits standard looks instead at whether or not the regulation or action materially limits or inhibits the ability of any competitor or potential competitor to compete in a fair and balanced legal and regulatory environment. So one of the big changes with this definition is it's no longer a requirement that there's no longer an insurmountable barrier. It is much broader than that. It looks at what you've allowed for competitors. It looks at whether or not you've created a standard that would, quote, materially inhibit a small cell provider to come into your right-of-way or to come into your city. As I mentioned at the beginning, it makes clear that this applies to both Section 253A and Section 332C7 of the Telecommunications Act. And we also believe that this new interpretation can also be applied to wireline facilities within the right-of-way. This will be one of those issues that's going to have to be litigated out in the courts, and we're going to have to see what happens in the next few years. The breadth of this standard is pretty large. We may be going back to the old Auburn case as opposed to the City of Anacortes versus T-Mobile case. One place to take a look at is the First, Second, and Tenth Circuit cases for guidance, because they have previously adopted this standard. So all of this is to say we've got a lot to learn in the next few years. I expect we're going to see a fair amount of litigation and a fair amount of interpretation out of the courts as to what does this materially inhibit standard mean as it relates to small cells, wireline facilities, and unfortunately, macro cells as well. So along with having to change our small cell codes and create new small cell codes to comply with this order, this new materially inhibit standard will have a direct effect on our macro codes as well. So when taking a look at updating your code for small cell, I also strongly recommend that you take a look at your macro cell code and see if it cites to a significant gap in coverage or least intrusive means. One area that we often see that type of citation occurs when you ask in an application for testing, coverage testing, to see whether or not T-Mobile, Sprint, Verizon actually has sufficient coverage. So take a look at what your application requirements are, take a look at your review requirements, and how that will be affected by this new materially inhibits standard. The other thing that changed with these new rules is a new definition for co-location. And what they've done is they have adopted the co-location definition consistent with the 2009 programmatic agreement. As many of you may have been aware, this was a discussion had between the wireless community and municipalities across the nation as to what is a co-location. And many municipalities took the perspective that co-location is really when you site an additional facility on top of a pre-existing structure with a wireless facility on it. So if you look at the picture here, if we were to put up a fourth macro facility on this building, it would have been considered a co-location according to many city codes. However, and unfortunately for city codes, now they have changed it to mounting or installing an antenna facility on a pre-existing structure. So it's not limited to whether or not that pre-existing structure has a current wireless facility. It just matters whether or not the structure exists. In addition, they've defined it as modifying a structure for the purpose of mounting or installing an antenna facility on that structure. So it will include modifications. Confusingly, it does not adopt the definition used for eligible facility requests. So one thing to consider is adopting a code that shows that here's the co-location requirements for macro and small cell, but notes that there is a different definition with regard to co-location for eligible facility requests. So the next piece, and in my mind, maybe one of the most aggravating pieces of the new FCC order is the elimination of the proprietary versus regulatory, what we would have called exception. So in many cases, cities have said, hey, if you want to use our poles for a small cell facility, that's great. Enter into a lease agreement. And those poles are proprietary. So therefore, we don't need to follow shot clocks and we can charge fees that we would want. Well, that was the old way of doing things, according to the FCC. They find that localities are fulfilling a regulatory function when managing the right-of-way, not a proprietary function. And they extend that analysis to infrastructure owned by a municipality in the right-of-way. The FCC concluded that Congress did not intend to allow cities to rely on their ownership of poles within the right-of-way as a, quote, pretext to advance regulatory objectives such as aesthetic requirements or market-based fees. So since municipalities are operating in a regulatory capacity, the FCC feels that they can then determine what is considered fair and reasonable compensation on behalf of the cities, as opposed to the cities determining what that constitutes, which previously cities have thought of that to be fair market value. Now, with regard to existing agreements, this is where the FCC really kind of punted, and they said that it's questionable whether or not their new order will affect them. And they're clear that they need to take a look at this on a case-by-case basis. So for those of you that have existing agreements, do not throw them in the garbage just yet. Let's take a look at them. Let's think about them. And let's let the carriers actually come to us and say, hey, we've got a problem. We're not going to pay you these fees. I don't recommend just taking the FCC order and saying, well, since this applies, all of our lease agreements are totally out the door. So something to just bear in mind there. As I said before, this new rule is going to apply to any management of the right-of-way. And so that's going to include light poles, traffic lights, utility poles, and similar property suitable for hosting small wireless facilities. So, and when we talk about similar property, they weren't very specific here, but one thing to think about might be your trash cans. There's been some discussion on trash cans in the right-of-way being areas to place equipment for small cell facilities. So I think that this could be potentially very broad. So as I said before, one of the major pieces that occurred with the FCC order is a determination on what fees could be. So fees are now considered need to be a reasonable approximation of objectively reasonable costs. So the FCC rejected the fair market value standard. They specifically rejected the usage of percentage of gross revenues. And so what did they leave us here? They left us here with what is the actual cost? How much does it really cost us to site a small cell facility on a city-owned structure? Now, beyond that, though, it also applies to all fees paid to the municipality. So that would include any fees related to permitting, and that would include any fees related to your electrical permits or traffic control permits. So not just a small cell permit specifically for siting. Not only that, they gave us another three-point standard. It says fees need to be reasonable approximation of costs. Those costs themselves have to be reasonable, and they can't be discriminatory. So in dealing with what are those costs themselves are reasonable, one of the issues that the FCC took a look at is costs related to third-party consultants. And they said that they're not going to disallow the usage of third-party consultants, and they're not going to consider that objectively unreasonable, but they warn that the cities must still abide by the principles of actual costs and that those costs must be reasonable, and therefore the consultant costs may not be excessive charges. So something to think about when using a third-party consultant is how does that compare to an actual cost if you were going to process that permit? Now, the FCC did leave us with some safe harbors. So the first is $500 for the first five applications, $100 for each additional application, $1,000 for each new pole, and then $270 for reoccurring fees. Now, these safe harbors are for all processes put into one. So it's not just the permit. It would also be siting on your utility pole or your light standard. I would venture to say that this is probably not a realistic amount of money, considering how much it would likely cost the city to process the permits, especially the initial permits, as you're starting to get a feel of what is it like to process these permits. So my suggestion would be is to have a permit fee schedule, like you do typically with your right-of-way construction and development standards, and quite literally take a look at the time you are spending to process those permits and come up with what are your actual costs related to siting a small cell. So the next piece of goodie that the FCC shared with us was redefining small cell. And in this redefinition, they give us some height constraints, which I think are fairly unclear and could potentially lead to some absurd results. So, for example, the facility is mounted on structures no more than 10% taller than other adjacent structures. Well, what does that mean? Are we going to include skyscrapers here? It's, to me, absolutely unclear. So we're going to have to see how the FCC and the courts start to determine what does the sub one here mean with regard to height. They also give us an antenna volumetric requirement, and they say that that volumetric requirement is per antenna, and they do not actually give us a cap on the antennas. The other big change here is they move the equipment standard to 28 cubic feet. That's a pretty big change in Washington State, because in Washington State we had an RCW that encouraged the adoption of 17 cubic feet. But the big difference between the RCW and this FCC order is that the 28 cubic feet is a cumulative volume. So it includes all of those things like the disconnect switch, the exterior conduit, the electric meter that wasn't originally included in the 17 cubic feet. So when taking a look at the definition of small cell, I don't necessarily know that the 28 cubic feet is that big of a change from the RCW 17 cubic feet, it when you consider all of the pieces that come in with that. The next piece is aesthetic requirements. So again, the FCC decided that the materially inhibit standard could apply to the aesthetic requirements that a city may impose. And they require that the aesthetic requirements be reasonable, no more burdensome than those applied to other types of infrastructure deployments, objective, and published in advance. So generally speaking, these have to be generally applicable, but the guidance itself does not need to be specific. So for example, you can say that we want you to paint your equipment box to match the pole, but you don't necessarily need to say the exact Sherman-Williams color that it has to be. That type of specificity is not required by this ruling here. Other general design standards, including spacing off of a pole that is acceptable to the city or requiring that for not wooden poles that the conduit be placed internal to the pole, would be acceptable. What's interesting here is the FCC doesn't appear to understand the imbalance created by this standard. The wireless providers are refusing to adopt a uniform design standard, and in fact, when asked, when we've asked them to come up with a design standard that we could adopt that would kind of work for all of them or even work for just one carrier, they tell us that's going to change over time. And so the wireless industry is greatly encouraging general design standards, but that will really become problematic when looking at decorative or historic poles. The FCC also talked about undergrounding. So they acknowledged that undergrounding is an issue for wireless facilities, and they said that it would be likely an effective prohibition if wireless facilities cannot technically work if placed below ground. And they recommended that you take a look at the BDAC requirements. Lastly, they also talked about minimum spacing requirements, and I encourage you to take a look at that conversation, but also within the order, but also be very careful about using minimum spacing requirements, because that can also be seen as effective prohibition if a carrier cannot comply with the minimum spacing requirements in order to deploy their technology. Now, outside of the most recent order, there was another order that came out in August, and that one was about moratoria. Specifically, the August 3rd order prohibited moratoria. Now, this is not really news. The FCC has always required the municipalities to comply with the pre-existing shot clocks. So even if you had adopted a moratorium and a small cell or macro facility came in and with an application, you'd still have to process them within 90 or 150 days, regardless of whether or not there was a moratorium in place. But here the FCC went further. They said that not only are they prohibiting express moratoria, but also de facto moratoria. For example, a city cannot say that, hey, we're not going to permit any small cells until we have updated our code. A common statement made by cities in order to get ready for small cell deployment. So something to consider is that, again, going back to the first slide, really need to get standards in place by January 18th, because that comment of, hey, we just got to get our standards in place, will not necessarily toll an application. Now, maybe a carrier will be willing to sign a tolling agreement to that effect, but it will also be considered a de facto moratorium. One other piece, though, to note is that the FCC did say, though, that undergrounding moratorium that many cities have adopted are not impermissible. So, for example, some street code requirements, which providers sometimes refer to as moratoria, which are not designed to thwart construction but are instead designed to promote dig once policies, would still be permissible. So this does not throw away the five-year undergrounding moratorium that many cities have. And they also stated that general governance of the right-of-way is also not a moratorium. So rules regarding rights-of-way management, requiring construction coordination, bonding requirements, indemnity requirements, and requiring these types of negotiations, or just not even negotiations, requiring that they provide you insurance, would not be considered a moratorium. So over the last 15 minutes, I have covered a lot of material, and I recognize I did so pretty fast, but we've got a lot more to come in this presentation. At this point, I'm going to introduce my colleague, Emily Miner, to come and speak to us about shot clocks. Emily is an attorney in our municipal department and in our telecommunications team, and I'm very excited to introduce her to all of you. Thanks so much.
Good morning, everyone, and thank you, Alana, for that warm welcome. As Alana mentioned, my name is Emily Miner, and I'll be walking you through the shot clock changes in the FCC order. The FCC uses shot clocks to establish time frames within which state and local governments must complete the review of telecommunications applications. So the initial question to ask is what kinds of applications are subject to these shot clocks? And the answer is relatively broad. Shot clocks apply to any approvals that a local jurisdiction or a siting authority must issue under applicable law prior to the deployment of a telecommunications facility. This includes zoning approvals, building permits, electrical permits, permits for accessing the right-of-way, license agreements, leases for municipal property such as light poles, and it does also apply to franchise agreements. Under state law, currently cities have 120 days to negotiate franchise agreements, but this order effectively cuts that timeline in half, and cities still need to comply with the state law requiring two readings. So this is a pretty important timeline to take note of. So the FCC's order has shortened the shot clock timelines for applications looking to deploy small wireless facilities. Under the order, local governments now have 60 days to review an application for a small wireless facility located on an existing structure, and they have 90 days to review an application for a small wireless facility located on new structures. The timelines do not change if the application is for multiple deployments. This is generally called batching. If an application is looking to put multiple deployments out on existing structures, the timeline is still 90 days for review, and the same is goes if it's for multiple deployments on new structures, still 90 days. If it's an application for a mixed group of facilities on both old and new structures, the local governments have 90 days to review that application. The important thing to remember here is just that the shot clocks begin to run the day the application comes in, so we are just really encouraging local cities to review their application processes to ensure that everyone's complying with the appropriate timelines. The applications can be tolled. This is something that you can look at if there's if you determine that the application is incomplete. Shot clocks restart at zero for small wireless facility applications, so long as you notify the applicant within 10 days of it being of the application being submitted. If subsequent determinations of incompleteness are needed, the shot clock is paused, so long as the local government continues to provide notice within 10 days of the supplemental submittal that the submission did not fulfill that request. The really important thing to note here, though, is that you may not arbitrarily toll an application. The notification of incompleteness must identify which documents are missing and then the specific rule or regulation that's tied to the obligation for the applicant to submit those documents. The order also codified the existing shot clocks for non-small wireless facilities. So cities and towns now have 90 days, still have 90 days to review an application for a non-small wireless facility that would be located on an existing structure, and 150 days to review an application for a non-small wireless facility on a new structure. Similarly, non-small wireless facility applications can be tolled. As with the small wireless facilities, the shot clocks do start the day the application is submitted. Unlike the small wireless facility applications, though, shot clocks are only paused. They're not. There's no reset at zero for these types of applications. The local government has to notify the applicant within 30 days of receiving the application that the application is incomplete. And then for subsequent determinations of incompleteness, the local government should follow the same process and timeline as described for small wireless facility applications. That's simply to notify the applicant within 10 days that the supplemental submittal did not fulfill the request. And then again, remember, you just need to explain which documents are missing and identify the rule or regulation that creates that obligation. So finally, some notes of caution. Missing these timelines can have some serious consequences. Failing to meet the timelines constitutes a presumptive violation, and applicants may seek expedited injunctive relief in court within 30 days of the local government missing the review deadline. So it's really important that you comply with this deadline. And something also to note is that these shot clocks do not include eligible facilities requests, which are requests to modify an existing tower so long as the physical dimensions of the tower remains the same. These types of requests are deemed granted under Section 6409, so just a note that you need to separate out those types of applications. So I will now be handing the mic over to Scott Snyder. He's a senior member of the Municipal and Telecommunication Groups. Scott has represented local governments since the Carter administration. He advises Washington cities on public policy issues with an emphasis on telecommunications and personnel issues. Welcome, Scott.
Thank you, Emily, and good morning. I hope that you all recognize the FCC order as the end run that it is. Remember that the FCC order preempts the state as well as local government. And this end run is a testament to the work that many of you on the phone, as well as the AWC, put in over the last 2 years in the state legislature. You prevented us from being steamrolled, and the industry went to the FCC, a captive federal agency whose brief is to promote interstate commerce. And that brief has added emphasis in our current presidential administration. So when should you open your door? Many of your city councils may feel that they're in competition for technology. Citizens want better coverage. You don't want to spend the money and the time. We all know how tough it is to get the attention of the city council during the budget season. And your city simply wants to open the door. There are models available online. The FCC BDAC committee has a model, as well as the NLC. I'd note that the NLC model is more nearly in English, but both of these models have a hole that you'll need to fill, and that's with regard to aesthetic standards. They're strong on structure and process, but offer little guidance regarding appropriate aesthetic standards. And as we'll discuss, those aesthetic standards need to be tailored to your community. Take it or toll it. One of the impacts here is going to be the hardening of the arteries of the franchising process. Under Washington state law, the Lakewood case specifically, you're aware that franchises for the use of the right-of-way are contracts, that you can't impose the requirements. They have to be agreed to by the franchisee. The difficulty here is that when the right-of-way has been designated as an asset for the deployment of small cells, and your ability to exclude them from the community is ended, the franchise is going to be the sort of the point of entry for the small cell providers. I would note I'm going to use the term franchise. In your community, you may use a master permit, and as you're probably aware, under 3599 and the state statute, those two devices are the same process. As has been noted earlier in the presentation, however, the time limits and frames apply to all parts of that approval process, from the franchise to the right-of-way use entry authorization. So the burden is going to be on you to formalize your franchise model. Make sure that your model franchise, usually contained in city ordinance, contains the key and provisions from indemnity to relocation requirements. Those of you who have had the pleasure of negotiating with corporate counsel know that each corporation, each of the carriers, has their own personal preferences and oddities. When those oddities arise and the request comes to send that document to their corporate counsel, note the time frames that your city is under and that you may be forced to deny if they can't meet them within the comments. That is that the 90 days can be used as a tool to encourage corporate entities who want more detailed negotiation to toll. Now, toll what? As Emily noted, there are 90 days for new poles, 60 days to attach to existing poles. Understand that a carrier coming into your community is not going to want to go through the process twice. So practically, we're talking about 90 days to build new poles. And as been noted, that's 90 days to complete all parts of the approval process. That will put a burden on you to utilize administrative processes in your community. Think type one from the standard zoning construct. Now, my glass is always half full, so let me give you a spin that the presumption that Emily referred to can be a benefit to cities as opposed to preemption. As Emily noted, formerly under 6409A, we were discussing a deemed approved remedy. That is, if you didn't act, the application was deemed approved. The court process creates, I'd suggest, an opportunity if you carefully pick your spots. The order creates safe harbors, presumptively valid timeframes. The order, though, repeatedly refuses to use the deemed approved remedy and acknowledges that when you go to court, you're going to have an opportunity to prove your case. I'd suggest that that's a case you're going to want to build in advance. If you decide to adopt structures to protect critical elements, and we'll talk about those in a second, that you carefully set a legislative record to defend it. Think now about the experience we went through 20 years ago in Washington cities with the adoption of adult entertainment ordinances. In order to defend those ordinances, cities adopted white papers and extensive documents by incorporation in the legislative record. Each of your cities has many tools that you could use. Comp plan documents often contain extensive references to streetscapes and critical areas. Your transportation improvement plan and CIP documents are another resource. Grant applications, grant requirements are a third. And don't forget the state and federal dockets. Structures such as shorelines, SEPA, the protections that cultural and archaeological resources, such as former Indian villages, burial sites, and middens receive under federal law, can also be an excellent source of national policy and documents to support a longer process. But again, you need to pick your spots, and they're going to vary from community to community. Shorelines, that's almost low-hanging fruit. Small cell technology does not work well in shorelines areas for technical processes, but that is an area where you may wish to adopt a longer time frame for review. Protect your streetscape investments. One of our clients has spent over $3.5 million developing a streetscape plan, installing a common look, furniture, and making improvements in their downtown area. I suggest that that's the sort of investment that a federal judge would appreciate if you set the table appropriately. Historic districts are discussed in the order. They were subject to frequent comment by cities in the process leading up to the declaratory ruling. They aren't given special protection, but there is a wealth of supportive material from both at the state and federal level to help build a legislative record. The question here is a legislative record for what? And that gets to the role as you go forward of using your planning commission and your design board. You have to publish aesthetic standards, has been noted. Now that leads us back to our two time frames, January 14th versus April 15th, 2019. Consider using construction standards adopted by administrative rule or an interim zoning ordinance in order to get something in place to protect your right-of-way. Most of the action is going to be in the right-of-way for the simple reason that it's the cheapest deployment for the industry. The emphasis will be there initially. Remember the non-discrimination provisions. You don't want to set a low bar for entry to the right-of-way because you're going to have difficulty raising that bar in the future. Pending adoption of those design standards that may come forward in through your planning commission. Now, the other question is, what sort of standards do you want to put in place? We're all aware of the admonitions of the Washington courts in cases such as Anderson versus Issaquah. Show your work, use pictures, have clear standards that appropriately limit a permitting discretion. In this case, it's going to be also necessary to give good guidance to your staff because these are primarily going to be administrative permits that are issued. But consider whether, and this is going to be a policy decision for your council, planning commission, and potentially design boards, do you want to use process so that you have clear standards for the administrator to use? Or do you want to use one of the Anderson-approved techniques and use pictures or specific designs with an appropriate carve-out for feasibility? Regardless of which process you use, I'd suggest that most of it should be in place by January 14th using interim standards or construction guidelines through Public Works. And then kick it to your planning board or design commission to come up with either a process or standards for those critical areas that your city wants to protect. I'm going to turn the mic over now to Daniel Kenny. Daniel's the Milton City Attorney. He regularly advises the cities of Gig Harbor, Mukilteo, and Issaquah, and is a key part of our telecommunications team.
Thanks, Scott, and thanks to everybody for sticking with us on the small cell order. As you can tell, there's a lot on the small cell order, and the small cell order is effective January 14, 2019. So that's a key emphasis for this presentation and your takeaway. However, the FCC also published at the exact same time a new notice of proposed rulemaking, and I've got the docket number.
Okay, so did you guys all get that?
Actually, I've listened to it twice now, and it really helps going through the second time, because I heard stuff I didn't hear the first time.
Yes. So, for those that are interested and for those that couldn't make it, I think we'll send the link out to the other planning commissioners. But as you can see, there's a lot of issues that are out there. Some of them are going to be more directed at the council as far as what we're going to charge, those sort of issues. They'll probably come through the planning commission, but I think that it's sort of a revenue kind of an issue. It's not necessarily how they're going to look, but sort of what kind of revenues the city gets. But there's a lot of things to be considered. Timing, process, a lot of it's procedural and process, and a lot of it's the aesthetics and what it looks like. So anyway, that open up for questions.
My question is, I guess, procedural. Do these have to go through environmental review? And if they do, how do you coordinate between the time requirements 150 days for under these statutes that they're talking about and statutes that constitute the environmental review in Washington.
Most of the wireless communication facilities are exempt from SEPA. They've been given a preemption at that level as well. So unless there are certain things that are very special about it, it'd be like issuing a building permit for a single-family house. It's not really – there isn't an extra time frame for that. Now, the regulations themselves, if they're procedural, they may have to go through some sort of a SEPA analysis as well. But since they're actually adding – think about it. Actually, we're going to have to do something because it is going to open up some things, allow more things than we had before. So it is kind of going that direction. So we'll probably have some sort of a SEPA process to deal with. But we haven't really thought that far out yet. Yeah, I agree with you. I think we're going to have like a workshop with our city, try to work out some sort of frame the issues with staff and kind of prepare it, and then have, and we may end up trying to get some public here, too, to talk about it. I don't know what kind of interest this is going to draw from outside of just the staff and the Planning Commission and the council. Historically, the city has not gotten too wound up about wireless facilities, but this is going to push them in areas that they haven't been before. So.
On that, I mean, it, what I got out of it was aesthetics, and things like, you know, you could make the conduit be internal to the pole and all that kind of thing. But they also talked about you have to be fair and consistent, and then minimum spacing. And do you have a sense of what that minimum spacing is? Is it every 100 feet they need one of these, or every? I just have no idea how many of these we might be looking for in the community, you know.
Yeah. I've done some reading on it, and they say a few hundred feet is the coverage from a small cell versus like a couple of miles from a macro cell. So at least from what I've read, it says that they're a really good application for a dense area like a downtown. So I'm not sure how that would work in our residential area because they would have to be every couple hundred feet.
That's what I was wondering, yeah, because I could see it being very attractive to the community having 5G and, you know, the parts of where we have the high density, the apartments, the condominiums, and there's a way to get it. But, yeah, it could be every light pole in one of the older flats or something.
Or maybe it'll just be in the downtown area or the commercial area or something.
And if you have several carriers, well, then, you know, it might be every third pole for Verizon, but then, you know, T-Mobile's going to take the next one,
pole. That was what I was wondering.
Then you have to put up new poles. And then what I've heard, and I'm not an expert, but it's probably going to come through in phases because the downtime might come first, but if these autonomous cars are supposed to work everywhere, I've heard they have to have 5G available. And so that may mean they need to be placed along the highways and I'm not sure, but it's probably not going to come in all at once because it's quite a sizable investment to do this. We're just starting to look at those. We've done a couple of looks for some of the local cities around here, and there's not really a great model that we say, oh, let's just grab that off the shelf. There's some descriptive kind of things in text that we've seen.
And some of what we have, too, like with our concealment, painting it to match the pole, a lot of what we sort of already have for the macro, but nothing, like Tom said, that I thought was awesome as far as that aesthetic standards go.
Do we know what these packages are going to look like? Are they football size? Are they 3 feet?
Well, there were some photographs on there. Some.
I saw that picture, and that's what they are.
Well, they had some pictures of some macro, and they also had some pictures of some of the smaller ones. And some of the antennas are yay big and it's sitting on top, but then there's a big box that either goes on the pole or it sits on the ground or it can sit in a vault underneath. But it also said, from what I heard on there, was it to make them put all the little vaults underground is probably considered a, what do they call it? What do they call it? Prohibition of some kind.
Yeah.
So we're going to need some advice from our attorneys.
Yes.
Yes. Clear. And obviously, we're going to try to make them look as nice as possible, but I think at the other end, I think our hands are somewhat, our options are somewhat limited, so we got to be prudent in this thing.
Our hands are tied to a point, because you can't deny access to the airwaves, so you can't say they're going to be something behind a billboard, for example. But it is possible, as we've seen it done in other cities, to have them restricted to be under the eave of a building if there's a roof line, to go on existing poles. Or if they're out in the open with nothing around, the California view will require them to put fake trees up along the I-80 corridor. And it was held to be absolutely legal for the cities to do that.
Well, I think that some of that is probably still true. I know that right now they're allowed to go up to 10% higher than any existing building that they're on, and it's stayed straight out that way. And she gave the skyscraper example, that if you had a pole, it says adjacent place, you could have a small building and a big building. If that's the adjacent building, you could build a pole 10% higher than the skyscraper. She said that's kind of an absurd interpretation or sort of circumstances, probably wouldn't happen that way. But so we're going to need some legal counsel to sort of talk about what is in play and what isn't.
Well, here again, using your really absurd example, it require, you know, a pole 10 feet above. What's the distance required between carriers? And if you put one pole up and it's a 20-foot pole, and you put three, it would require them to go on the existing pole rather than having a
Yeah, I don't know. I don't see a lot of multiple carriers on the small cells from the pictures we've seen. I think it's kind of the structures are smaller. But those are all good, great questions that we're going to hopefully be able to answer for you in the future.
Well, one of the things, it sounds like for your standards, if they're already published and already in existence, then it sounded like you could have a bit stricter aesthetic requirements as long as they were pre-existing.
I think if they're talking about the moratorium part, they were saying that if you had certain rules in place that, like, you can't cut your roads after you put a new road in, or you know, certain things like that that are part of doing your right-of-way processes and stuff, that didn't affect it. But I do think that we can't still prohibit things. We can't, if our processes are inconsistent, we can't keep them there. Like for example, we have one now about the distance in between. We require this study to show that there's not a gap in coverage, or there is a gap in coverage, and we can't do that anymore. So we're going to have to take that out. The aesthetic stuff, all we have right now is that concealment technology. You have to paint it the same color, try to make it not stand out as much as possible. So it's not anything we can really hang our hat on at this point. We don't know yet. I imagine it's going to come in phases, probably where the most people are that probably want the service, and they'll probably fade out. But I don't know the answer to that question, really. And that answer might even change over time as far as what's necessary.
The aesthetic, which is what could be either text or, I know we've done signs via picture, and it would be interesting to have you go back and come to us with what you find. It seems like, I would assume, both in state and in other regions of the country, people are grappling with the same issue and the same FCC deadline, I'm guessing, or was it?
Yeah. It wasn't adopted that long ago, so it's a pretty quick window. And one thing that we have in the city
like in my dream of how this could work out is if they're going to use the city's poles that we have a pretty standard one that's in the original development, and there's some of the areas that we've annexed. Is you could create a prescriptive that if you do it this way, it's real easy. You just do it that way. And if you want to propose something else, well, then it requires some. Then you have some text that would sort of describe kind of what it would have to look like, or and so the easy way is to do it the way we say. But then they also say that none of these people will say exactly what their facilities look like or commit to a certain thing. So, again, we don't have the answers yet, and we're going to be working to do that over the next few months. But I think it's very likely that we'll probably have some sort of general descriptive kind of ordinance in place as an interim, just so, and maybe change some of the time frames and some of the processes quicker rather than later.
Local light poles are owned by the city, maintained by Snohomish County PUD. Is that right?
Most of them are owned by the PUD, right? Mm-hmm. We looked at a map. The ones that are like in North Point, Town Center, Main Street, there are some with the green ones that don't look like the typical PUD poles. Those are ours. But most of them are owned by the PUD.
Okay, so this is basically PUD, who's also subject to this as a public agency.
Right, but they're in the right-of-way. So, yeah, so that's another thing. How do we – we've got an email from somebody. The PUD is starting to ring us up a little bit and – want to know what we're doing.
See the high voltage, you know, poles being one setup versus the street light pole being a different setup, and we don't know from the carriers what their preferred, what's going to work best for them technically or anything like that.
No, nobody's even come to talk to us from the provider side, so I don't know if Mill Creek's on the list or not.
Yeah.
You know, they're gonna roll that out over time, and they haven't been to our counter yet.
Thank you very much.
More to come.
Stay tuned. Good to the order.
Have we sent them the links for the training yet?
Oh, no. I mean,
for the mandatory training?
Yeah, I know. Actually, the training that you guys take, I know that some of you have sent me your confirmation or certificate that you took it. Could everybody email me with the, because I'm supposed to track it. I'm supposed to keep track of dates and whatever. Could you email me when you took that training? And it can be approximate. If you don't have a certificate, if you know you took it. Yeah, I've got your stand, but we're supposed to have a refresher every 4 years, and I'm supposed to be tracking that.
At this point, I'm 12 years ahead.
Yeah, you're good. And I could see if I can find some more local training or also send you the link again where you can do that online.
You can send the link online if you want to go along with this presentation.
Oh, yeah, I'll send them both.
Yeah, but yeah, the state law requires it every 4 years, basically public meetings, sort of procedural.
And we've been kind of loose on that, just telling people, but not making sure and following up and tracking. So.
Well, it's important because it's the one area that open litigation is
All right, thank you. Okay, now that's pretty good.
Okay.
Services on board where I can sit back and wait, let people just bring work to me to look at.
We'll have a December meeting, I'm assuming.
Yeah, probably.
Yeah, we should. Hopefully, you know, if we don't have anything ready to do it yet, I suppose we wouldn't, but I think we're going to. We have to.
I'm not sure if you guys heard, but Ken Long, our
former yes.
passed away Saturday.
Yeah, I got somebody, his daughter, shared, posted so something that kind of got shared around. I referred to a few people that
August out with his walker and really frail. And he'd get together at Christmas time and one of the neighbors. And,
yeah. He did a couple years ago. He did
the art stuff, thing.
And he was still looking pretty old. But he was still moving around. And
last time he seen him, he was Christmas. He was good. This summer I saw him. He was a lot more frail than he was. And then I was talking to Barry.
It's all of our futures, so
yeah.
That's the scary part. You make sure.
Cool.
Remind you.